So the title is Bright Brains for Rick, and the plan is, even though a lot of remarks have been made during the week, and Rob gave a really nice summary for introduction, I can't refrain from starting with some of my own remarks. Then I'm going to talk about photon production by strongly coupled plasmas. After that, I don't know how far we're going to get, but this is the plan. It will depend on the chairman. I'll talk about viscosity of fundamental matter, then finite variant density or chemical potential, and some future directions. Now, the reason I decided to start with this part is because this is actually work in progress. It's not published. And so I'm hoping to benefit from a lot of feedback here. So please feel free to correct me or make comments or just give me feedback. OK, so let me start by stating the obvious, which is that we are all here because QCD is still a challenge. It's an old hope that string reformulation might help with that challenge. We now have a lot of examples of dualities between gauge theories, strongly coupled gauge theories, and gravity. But unfortunately, because QCD is asymptotically free, we cannot access it, strictly speaking, via supergravity, because we can only study in these approximation theories that remain strongly coupled all the way up to the UV. And so what this means is that certain quantitative questions in QCD, such as, for example, what is the detailed mass spectrum material temperature, will require going beyond supergravity. However, certain predictions which you can extract from supergravity may be universal enough to apply, at least in certain regimes, for QCD. And let me emphasize that what predictions and what regimes is actually part of the challenge, understanding exactly which ones. Now, a good example of that is the calculation of the ratio between the viscosity and the entropy density, which we all know about by now. The point is that this calculation was done in 2001 by this gentleman, and it turned out later that this is a universal property for all gauge theories for which we have a gravity rule. There's no counterexample to that in this context. It holds in different dimensions, with or without fundamental matter, with or without chemical potential, et cetera. And so this gives us confidence that perhaps all plasmas look alike as far as this ratio goes. Okay? And so a couple of observations I'd like to make is that the authors who calculated that for n=4 didn't know this when they did it. And so the message is we should calculate everything we can and then try to understand if it's universal. And the more universal it is, the more confident we are that perhaps it may apply to QCD, perhaps. Now, the other thing I'd like to emphasize is that the reason this is a universal property is because it's a property of black hole horizons. And it turns out that in the Large Chern limit, the deconfined phase of any gauge theory has a black hole horizon in the dual supergravity description. And so this is a universal property. And in some ways, you may say that everything I've been doing the last year or year and a half has been trying to exploit this universal property with another one, which is the fact that in a very, very large class of gauge theories, introducing a small number of flavors, fundamental matter, corresponds to introducing brain probes in this supergravity background. And so if you combine the two ingredients, for example, you can derive that it's a very universal result that there's a first order phase transition that Rob just described, in which the brains fall through the horizon, and that corresponds to meson melting in the gauge theory. Any questions so far? OK, so let me start then with photon production. So let's go back to thinking about the quark gluon plasma Kaluza 3, for example. The reason photons are an interesting probe is because this is because of the fact that the electromagnetic coupling constant is weak and the finite extent of this fireball, the quark gluon plasma is supposed to be optically thin. And that means that once you produce a photon, even if it's deep in the fireball, it will escape virtually unaffected with no further scattering with the plasma. And so it will carry valuable information about the properties of the plasma where it was produced. So that's motivation. Now, of course, calculating that in strongly coupled QCD just above the phase transition is very hard. We don't really know how to do that. In the lattice, it's problematic. And so these authors here have actually calculated that rate of photon production and other properties in n=4 super young mills and another theory I'm not going to describe. But in both cases, This has been done for massless matter. In particular, the first case, it's a theory with massless matter in the action. And so what I'm going to tell you today is how you do that in the models that Rob described, in which you have fundamental matter. And in that case, the quark mass is a parameter that you can tune. It's just the distance between the brains and the black hole. And so let me also say that, keeping in mind possible applications to real-world physics, such as heavy-ion collisions, in those collisions, you produce photons in very different phases of the collision. You produce photons because of the collision between the initial particles before you reach thermal equilibrium. You also produce photons once the firewall equilibrates. But then when it hadronizes, you also produce photons subsequently. So experimentally, it's not easy to distinguish between all these sources. And so we should keep in mind. And the calculation that I'm going to do is supposed to be a first step at calculating the photon production from this source, because I'm going to assume that I have an infinitely extended, completely equilibrated plasma. OK, now the point is, we are going to consider SUN super-Yang-Mills theories coupled to NF flavors, hypermultiplets. And these theories don't have a dynamical photon. And so you could imagine that the theory that you want is, so these theories, if you take, let's say, all the quarks who have equal mass for simplicity, have a global symmetry, flavor symmetry, and the overall U1 is the baryon number. And in order to couple this theory to electromagnetism, what you might imagine doing is modifying the Lagrangian by introducing a new dynamical field, a U1 gauge field, the photon, which is going with the kinetic curve, which is going to couple to all these fields through this electromagnetic current. This is just a conserved current associated with this global symmetry that you're gauging. And note that the covariant derivative acting here, because this theory has scalar fields, contains not only the SUN fields, but also the photon. And note as well that if you proceed in this way, which is what I'm going to imagine doing, I'm assigning zero electric charge to the fields in the adjunct representation. I'm only assigning electric charge, maybe a direct coupling to the photon, to the fields, the fermions, and the scalars in the fundamental. That's a reasonable thing to do, because the ultimate goal is to model as well as we can QCD, and in QCD there are no adjunct fields. So if you gauge that U1 in that way, you obtain an SUN.
But it is not U1B, it is electric charge's combination, U1B and isotopic, right?
Right.
No, it was in your previous transparency.
Which you could have easily mimicked if you wished to.
Yeah, in fact, the result is very insensitive exactly to what you choose. And you'll see that, in fact, also in a certain limit coincides with what you get in N equals 4 when you get an R symmetry U1. OK, so if you obtain this SUN cross U1 theory in this way, then in thermal equilibrium, the rate of photon emission to leading order in the electromagnetic coupling constant is given by this well-known formula, where K is the photon momentum, so it's a null momentum. Chi is the spectral density, and G is just the retarded correlator of these two electromagnetic currents. So in principle, we need to calculate this retarded Green's function for these two electromagnetic currents in a theory that's SUN cross U1, for which we don't know a gravity dual. We only know a gravity dual to the SUN theory with no dynamical photon. But the observation that allows us to get away is that to leading order in the electromagnetic coupling constant, you can drop this term from the current, because when you plug it in here, it's going to give you something that's higher order in E. And moreover, you can calculate the correlator in the original SUN theory, which means that this expression is going to be correct to leading order in E, but it's going to incorporate, so there are no photons running in this diagram over here, which is a two-point function you're calculating. And so the result is going to be non-perturbative in the SUN interactions, but only correct to leading order in the electromagnetic coupling constant. And so the goal then is to do a holographic calculation of this two-point function of these two electromagnetic currents. Now, the way you do that is very simple, because remember that the gauge theory with coupled to NF flavors of equal mass corresponds to, as Rob explained, to introducing NF overlapping D-brains in the dual gravitational background. And of course, you all know that global symmetries in the gauge theory map to gauge symmetries in the gravity description. And so this global symmetry is just the gauge symmetry, the UNF gauge symmetry on NF overlapping D-brains. And correspondingly, the conserved current maps, is dual, is an operator, which is dual to a field, which is nothing else but the, it's nothing but the overall U1 gauge field on the D-brains. And so then, just by applying the ABCFT prescription, you know that the, this two-point function is essentially given by taking two functional derivatives of the action for the D-brains with respect to this gauge field. So poetically, you could say that the dynamical photon does not live in the gauge theory, it lives in the dual brains, and so it makes them bright brains, hence the title. Now, before I tell you what the result is, let me make a couple of comments. The first one is that I'm going to calculate photon production in the phase in which the mesons have melted, namely for black hole embeddings as a function of the quark mass and the photon frequency. The reason is that in this one, in the large N limit, the spectrum consists of absolutely stable with no width particles. And so you expect the spectral function just to be a sum of well-defined delta functions. And there is a mass gap, so all these delta functions have support only at positive m squared. And I want to calculate the spectral density at null momentum. And so there is no contribution. Again, in the large end, this is a large end approximation. And the second comment is that there is no obvious comparison, at least, of the results I'm going to obtain as far as the dependence on the quark mass goes to perturbative QCD calculations, because in these calculations, it is usually assumed that the thermal mass of the quark is always much greater than the bare quark mass, which is, of course, an assumption about how high the temperature is. But note that regardless of what is the precise range of temperatures for which this is a good approximation, the very nature of this approximation assumes that there is a concept, a meaningful concept, of a quark-like quasi-particle to which you can attribute a thermal mass. This is not the case in this phase. In this phase, the excitations on the brains do not behave as quasi, as quark-like or anything else, quasi-particles. It really behaves like a strongly coupled liquid. Nevertheless, there is a parameter on which the physics does depend, which is the quark mass. This is just a bare quark mass. And you will see that the photon production, for example, is sensitive.
But how it could be, you know, if you have a kind of mass quark in the media, then this would be defined by certain length, analog of the seminal mass, whatever. Something would stop emission before you would be sensitive to mass of the quark. So how it could, it looks like a very, very much a physical. I'm considering kind of limit where MQ goes to zero.
Well, MQ doesn't have to go to zero.
No, it doesn't have, but let's say that we are considering this.
Okay, I'll tell you what the result is for MQ equals zero in particular. And then, okay, maybe we can discuss it after that. Okay, so this is the result. This is for the D3D7 system. Okay, so it's N equals 4 sub Young Mills coupled to NF hypermultiplets. What's plotted here is the trace of the spectral function, which is what enters the photon production, normalized or divided by essentially NFNC, which is the number of degrees of freedom in the fundamental, times T squared and divided by omega, where omega is the photon frequency divided by the temperature. Now, the solid lines correspond to values of the quark mass for which the black hole embeddings are thermodynamically stable. Remember, there's a phase transition between Minkowski embeddings and black hole embeddings. And they range from n equals 0, which is this green line at the top, all the way down to about little m equals 1.3. Remember, little m is essentially the quark mass divided by root lambda t. And so the result for zero quark mass is actually, up to normalization, is exactly the result obtained by these authors. And that's because, just a second, because in that limit, the used geometry on the seven brains is ABS 5 crosses 3 exactly. And so the only difference is that there's a difference in the normalization coming from the fact that there's an S3 and an S5.
No, I just want to clarify whether this is real photons or data photons.
These are on-shell real photons. But the momentum, thank you, the momentum is null. There's an interesting calculation we haven't done that you could do for off-shell photons, which then would tell you about dielectric production. Yeah, but this is just the first step. So this is really on-shell photons. And you see that if you look at zero frequency or small frequencies, something that at least to me seems intuitive happens, which is that the maximum, the spectral function is greater when the quark mass is the smallest. So as you increase the quark mass, you go down and the spectral function decreases. So heavier quarks, so to speak, radiate less.
Yeah, but this is always was true in electrodynamics. The lightest particles emitted the most, right? You know,
yes,
because it's acceleration.
But I'm not saying this is, I said this is intuitive to me. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that.
No, but it means that, the fact that light particle emits more, you know, this is just standard dipole emission.
He's saying it's intuitive to him, too.
He's agreeing.
So I agree. So I'm glad we agree. Let me carry on, because that's true at low frequencies. It's not true at intermediate frequencies.
No, in electrodynamics, it's low all the way.
Yeah, but this is not electrodynamics. But this is not electrodynamics. That's what I'm. Let me go over the features of this plot.
No, yeah. Then I would say that effectively your particle become heavier in this range, because otherwise it would be not understandable. Effective mass would be like heavy in this range.
Okay, let me describe a few of the features, and then I'll be glad if you find it counterintuitive, because maybe then there's something interesting. So on the other extreme, this falls off as omega to the minus 1/3, which is also a result you can show analytically. The reason, from the dual perspective, the reason why this decreases over here at low frequencies is that the area of the induced horizon on the brains, as you increase the quark mass, decreases. And so the smaller the hole, sorry, the bigger the black hole, the brighter the plasma. Now, over here, you see that there is some structure. And so, for example, if you take this line, or this line and this line, okay, this one has a smaller quark mass than this one. And you see they cross over here. And so, as a function of the quark mass at this frequency, the quark that's lighter emits less than the one that's heavier. And so that's represented also in this plot. This is the same quantity plotted now against the quark mass for different values of the frequency. And so you see that for zero frequency, which is the one on top, this is a monotonically decreasing function of the quark mass. So at zero frequency, it's true that the lighter the quark mass, the lighter the quark, the more it emits. But it's not true for intermediate values of the frequency. You see that it goes up here. Okay, so I don't know if that's counterintuitive to you, but maybe
I would say that this probably tells you that the notion of mass is frequency dependent.
Okay.
You see, because you can say that like effective mass is changing, and there's.
Well, this is this little end here. This is the bare quark mass. This is the.
No, bare quark mass doesn't make much sense if you consider the light, very light quarks, because then you have other infrared parameters which are more which would be working as an infrared cutoff earlier than that. So consider and you do have these parameters in the media, right? So it only makes sense when mass is larger than size.
This mass can be larger, can be doesn't have to be small.
But that is a physical parameter theory.
It is a physical parameter, yeah.
Yeah, but effectively, let's say the temperature is light. So then we are talking about heavy quarks, if you like, when you're discussing this. It's heavy quark, not light.
Yes.
No,
let me say it again.
Where is this parameter?
Let me say it again. This little m, which is the ratio between the quark mass and root lambda times t, can go from 0 to 1. And so it can be as light as massless or as heavy as
root lambda. No, it's the units of t. And t is what?
No, t
is what? Yeah. So that's why all masses which are where this ratio some number correspond to heavy quarks in my language.
If it's a finite fraction, yes, but I can set it to 0. But anyway, let me continue and we can. Thank you. So in particular, the curve on top is the curve for zero frequency. And because what's plotted here is the ratio between the spectral density and the frequency, this is giving you directly after normalization the electrical field. OK, now this is what I plotted before is the spectral density, which goes into the total photon, the rate of photon production, which is what's plotted here. This object has also a Boltzmann suppression factor, which is why these curves go down. But again, the same thing I said before about the fact that these two curves cross still persists. As you can see here, this is just a video, a zoomed-in version of that plot. So you see that for certain values of the photon frequency, the quark that's heavier emits more photons than the quark that's light. These are basically the same plots for the D4D6. The same features I just described also show up here. The curves also cross. And so, and the same thing, these are two theories in four dimensions, D3D7 and D4D6. We have also done it for the D2D6, which is a three-dimensional theory, and the same features persist. So if there is something, there seem to be some rough features of these graphs that are universal. So, and I'm not sure yet about what the best interpretation is, but that's why it's working perfect.
But in the realistic case of our light quarks, can I say that your small m is just always zero?
Hmm? Sorry, say that again.
Our realistic quarks have mass few mev, right? UMP quark has mass few mev.
That's right.
Numerically, in terms of your parameter m, what numerical value it does correspond?
Zero.
Zero.
Yeah. Zero. Right. That's right. That's why I mean what I'm saying is so it's essentially I mean if you're talking about
UMP quarks at temperatures above the confinement. I agree. It's 13.
Yeah, it's what I meant.
Okay. Any more questions about that? Otherwise, we'll move to the next 2 points. Good. So let me just remind you that these authors have conjectured that 1/4π is a universal lower bound for relativistic quantum field theories at finite temperature for eta over s. We know this is saturated for all theories for which we have holographic dual with adjoint matter. A lot of examples have been worked out, both abstractly and in detail. Results from Rick indicate that the ratio is not too far. We can debate about the specific numbers, but it's not very large, apparently. And then you may ask, what happens if you include fundamental matter? The reason this is an interesting question is not only that QCD has fundamental matter, but also that the contribution from the quarks in the large hadron limit gives you the first and leading 1/n correction. Any other correction coming from the glue or the adjoint is going to be suppressed by 1/n². And so the contribution from the fundamental matter is the first and leading and most important contribution. And given that this value is exactly saturated for theories with adjoint matter, the sign of the possible sign of this correction from the fundamental matter is going to decide whether it's still exactly saturated, whether it's violated, or whether you go above the bound. Okay? And so even just the sign is interesting. Now, the idea to compute this correction is actually very simple. Remember, you can extract the viscosity from a cubo formula that relates it to the two-point function of the stress energy tensor. But of course, holographically, we know that this operator is dual to graviton fluctuations in the bulk. And because the D-brains, the D-brain probes have a mass, they source this graviton, and so they couple to these fluctuations. And then in order to, roughly speaking, in order to compute the contribution to this viscosity of the fundamental matter, what you have to do is solve for the fluctuations of the graviton in the presence of the brains, and then evaluate their on-shell action and take two functional derivatives with respect to these fluctuations. Okay. I'm not going to go over the details, but there is. Let me just tell you what the result is. The result is that two leading order in an F over MC, okay, so the first correction, the ratio between eta and S is still exactly equal to 1 over 4 pi. It's not modified. The bound is still exactly saturated, even though the correction to eta and to S is non-trivial. And Rob just told you in the he had this plot, this function that he called capital H, because he's more senior. I call it little h. And so it's a function that goes, it's an order one function of this ratio. And the coefficient is lambda. And I can, you have a 16 because you convert it to. Okay. So, but the overall scale, you see that the correction is suppressed by nf over nc times lambda. Okay? So it's a non-trivial correction to eta, but exactly the same correction happens to s in such a way that the ratio is still equal to 1 over 4 pi. And so you notice, and he already emphasized, that you know from large chain counting this is going to be suppressed by nf over nc. But in fact, there's a power of lambda here, which is a prediction of the strong coupling calculation in ADS. And this happens not only for the viscosity, but generically for all transport coefficients. The correction from fundamental matter is always controlled by this ratio, this parameter. And I just want to quickly comment that this has a potential consequence for the idea that Krishna discussed about using the jet quenching parameter as a thermometer. Because if I understand correctly, the idea is that you assume that it has this functional form, as a function of the tooth coupling and the temperature, with a coefficient that you calculate in lots of different models, and then you have some confidence that it's.
But you go like square root of number of degrees of freedom.
Good. So, but if this is, I think the jet quenching is going to get a contribution from fundamental matter, a correction that's going to scale with lambda and not with lambda. And so the functional form as a function of the tooth coupling is more complicated.
But if the entropy density gets corrected in the same way, then it's just a matter of getting the numbers right to see where.
Right, maybe that's correct, yeah.
But if it would be entropy nf plus nc square, then it doesn't match lambda, right?
No, but the entropy density, he just said the entropy density gets corrected as shown here.
It's the same way.
So it's a question of seeing whether that c gets corrected by, it should be corrected by the same coefficient but divided by 2. Mm-hmm.
Does it also happen for other quantities like the biomass?
Like the?
The biomass?
No. How do you compute it?
The Debye mass. I don't have anything.
This is correction for some.
This is correction to essentially to two point functions of correlators from which you extract transport coefficients, so to speak.
Yeah, I guess entropy is still an area of horizon.
Absolutely. So you can still think of the.
You can break it with this horizon minus this whole one.
Roughly speaking, sorry. Yeah. Roughly speaking, yeah. Okay, so let me move to the last point then. 5 minutes? Okay, so remember I told you that the conserved current associated to baryon number in this gauge series is dual to a gauge field on the D-brains, on the probe brains. And so immediately from that, applying the gauge gravity prescription, you know that turning on a chemical potential for this conserved charge corresponds to turning on a non-normalizable mode of the dual field, of the field that's dual to the operator you're deforming your Hamiltonian with. And similarly, the vacuum expectation value of that operator, which is the baryon density, corresponds to the normalizable mode of the same field. And so once you know that this is the prescription, all you have to do is reanalyze to study the physics, at least the possible phase transitions. You have to redo the analysis with it, but now in the presence of this mode or that mode. So let me just tell you what happens if you work at finite density, if you choose your variable to be the density, not the chemical potential. What happens is that there are no longer Minkowski and black hole embeddings. All embeddings become black hole embeddings. And the reason for that is that turning on a density, a baryon number density, or quark density, corresponds to attaching some strings, as Rob explained, to the D-brains. And as soon as you do that, you can show that there is no equilibrium configuration. The tension of the strings always overcomes the tension of the brains, and so they pull them down through the horizon, and you're left with an electric flux on the brains, which, of course, at infinity, gives you a normalizable component of A naught, which is the baryon density. And so for densities below a certain critical density, there is still a phase transition. First of a phase transition, but now it's a phase transition between two different black hole identities. As you see over here, this is the same, a similar plot to the one that Rob had. This is the quark condensate versus the temperature. So you jump from here to here. But if you go to densities above this critical density, then this curve is single value. There is no phase transition. And so the phase diagram looks something like this. As I said, below a certain critical density, as you move along the temperature axis, you hit a line where there is a first of a phase transition. But this line terminates at a critical point. And so above this density, there is no phase transition as a function of the temperature. Let me skip these comments because they're not too relevant, and let me jump to just a few final, a couple of future directions. One of them has to do with the fact that a lot of work has been done at finite temperature and zero critical potential. That's very relevant for Rigg physics, but there is, of course, we would like to know more about the phase diagram of QCD for, in general, strongly coupled gauge theories. And so I think there's a lot of things to do which are within reach concerning finite density or finite chemical potential physics. In particular, we had a very nice talk about condensation that breaks some symmetry spontaneously, like rotational symmetry. There are also phases that break, for example, translation symmetry, chiral wave phases, in which the chiral condensate is non-homogeneous. You can also try to study physics of the Fermi surface. And for a lot of these things, you need a model, a holographic model, that has only fermions in the fundamental representation and not scalars, because otherwise they will tend to condense, both they condense, as opposed to building up a Fermi scene. And there is such a model, and so we are thinking about that. And then another slide with a few comments that I'd like to make has to do, just to recap a little bit, remember, what we've learned is that properties of black hole horizons in ADS encode properties of quark-gluon plasmas. In particular, static properties of horizons, such as the area, tell you about static thermodynamic properties of the plasma, such as the entropy density. Little fluctuations of black hole horizons, perturbative fluctuations, tell you about two-point functions or near-equilibrium properties, such as transport coefficients, like the viscosity. And one of the directions that I think is interesting is going beyond these little perturbations, going far from equilibrium, and that corresponds to large perturbations of black hole horizons. And of course, one of the strong motivations for that is to try to understand, if possible, or if it has to do really with strong coupling dynamics, the seemingly fast thermalization time observed at heavy ion collisions. Good. Any questions on that? So in that case, I don't have. Actually, I do have one conclusion, which is work hard and be universal. And also one comment to make, which is that I have been going to workshops of this type for a few years now, and it always felt in the beginning like the string theorists were trying to get somebody's attention and nobody was paying too much attention. And it's only recently that it seems that the two communities, meaning string theorists and everybody else, seem to have made each other respectable. And so I'm very glad to see that, and thank you for your attention.
Okay, so we'll open for discussion, and I also invite questions for the previous speaker in the beginning of the slide.
Well, I don't really want to, you know, throw cold water on what I agree with, because a lot of really nice work, and I like your conclusion. But your very last point, I just want to comment that I certainly suspect that understanding fast apparent thermalization at Rigg is really all about understanding a description from a regime where a weakly coupled description makes sense to a regime where a much more strongly coupled description makes sense. I just don't see how a satisfactory understanding of that can ever come from something which says, at the beginning, let us assume lambda equals infinity. So I actually think that's one question that is not well suited to these methods.
And what about approach and say, why do we assume lambda equals zero, which is equally far from that, right?
Well, so frankly, we're in some difficult intermediate regime. Lambda is not really small.
But this, for example, is proving the result. When lambda is equal to infinity, you still have finite result, which is very amazing.
Oh, yeah, I think there's lots of interesting questions which have to do with learning about properties of the quark muon plasma that we create that are really hopefully going to show up in probes of that plasma as it, of course, expands and cools. I just think that thinking we're going to use currently available gauge string duality techniques to describe the very earliest moments of the collision when, in a sense, you're really starting with the partonic description. And that just seems to me unlikely.
I'm sympathetic to that.
It's a function of scale. We don't know where the transition is. You may say partonic language. If you have 100 GeV jets, it's weakly coupled, right? If it is 1 GeV, 2 GeV, who knows?
No, but if you say this point of Larry, look, you got correction. Lambda multiplied by mf divided by nc, right? Take the limit lambda goes to infinity.
I assume the whole combination was small.
Well, right, but if you attempt to combine it with the limit lambda goes to infinity, it certainly presents a problem, right? Because then it looks like you need to resum this part, right? Because you have a small parameter in MF1C, but you have very large parameter lambda.
Yeah, there's an order of limits issue, I think.
Yeah, no, but it shows example of.
Larry,
I
was going to say to Larry, the comment to Larry.
Not going to comment on that.
Very short. I was going to say, Larry, I completely agree with you, and then I saw the abstract of the talk that Yuri Kovchegov is presumably going to give tomorrow. So I've only read the abstract of the paper, not the paper. I'm going to miss the talk, but you go to the talk and see whether he changes your mind.
I'm going to comment that this lambda nf over 8 pi squared, pi squared maybe. Let me ask you a question about the photon emission rate. So you showed that in the limit of large omega, you have an analytic result on the photon emission rate that goes like omega to the power of minus.
I didn't say it's analytic, because I haven't done it yet, but I'm convinced it is. For zero-quark mask, it is analytic, mm-hmm. because you have the whole curve analytically.
So my question is whether omega goes to infinity and lambda goes to infinity commute. You know when, because in perturbation theory, it's omega to a different power in the weakly coupled theory. So is there a limit of the limit commutation of limit issue, or the power itself is a function of the coupling constant?
No, I don't think the power is a function of the coupling constant.
So it might be just maybe
no. Basically, for high frequency, you are insensitive to what the quark mass is, because you can basically set it to zero, and then you get the same analytic result you get for zero quark mass. And I don't think there is.
It's not lambda dependent.
No, I don't think so.
Why should you agree with decoupling?
Because the decoupling, because you expect the smooth crossover between. Weak coupling. So there are two possible resolutions of the discrepancy. One is that the power itself is the smooth function of lambda, but he said it's not. And the other thing is that the two-limit probably does not commute.
No, but what I calculated for you is this power in the limit of infinite coupling.
Right. But
this power, if you compute one over lambda corrections, may get modified, but I haven't calculated that. What I'm showing is this power has a finite limit as lambda goes to infinity.
Yes,
I just wanted to add a little bit more to this question of priority. I think that in principle,
to the string community, it's clear that supergravity will take you only so far, and that at the end you have to use the string theory. And I think a lot of people realize that's where we're going. And there are already some string theories written down that have no problem with going to Lambda small.
Okay. My comment is also related to what Lenny said, and I tried to make a point at the end of my talk that all this dictionary, people have discussed here the determination of field theory correlators, but they are always standard field theory correlators between in and out states, as one defines in perturbation theory correlators. But the issue here is that you should have something which starts at some moment, starts with some T's here. And that's a completely different type. So does this whole approach apply to that kind of phenomenon? Hertzian collision, it starts at some moment.
Yuri seems to think it does, but he's not in the room.
Oh, but Yuri, I mean, that's of no relevance, I think.
The phone is discussed on the Yuri. Any other questions? Okay.
In this correction, you discuss this lambda NF divided by NC. There is also a perfect rate by the 1 over 80. So it is good.
Which is correct?
1 over 80. Yeah, 1 over 8, which is hundreds, it's small. But there is usually a physical interpretation if two limits do not commute. Here, large lambda limits and large NC limits do not commute, apparently, in this formula. So what's the physical interpretation there?
I don't think there's anything deep. I think this is a triple expansion in 1 over n, nf over n, and 1 over lambda. And so
all the time in the large NC limit, if the large NC do not commute with, long distance or some other limit, there's always a physical reason for that. There should be a physical reason for the TOC.
Except there's the easy part of the answer is if you want to not send lambda, if you want to not send NC to infinity first, then you should be thinking about the field theory. It's no longer conformal. And isn't it non-asymptotically free? So it's
but this breakdown down before that. And lambda NF over NC. Of order 1 is where it breaks down, not when NF over NC is of order 1. So there is, there might be a
problem. This sort of running at these lambda
functions.
This
is next to lambda.
Yeah. This is just
the lambda was lambda squared.
So I think this is just a reason to not be surprised at non uniformity depending on whether you send M large first.
If you take NF equal 1, and notice that NC, the lambda and downstairs cancel. But it's just alpha S.
Yes.
It's just alpha S.
Yes.
This parameter, nothing else.
There is no independence in this case.
So we assume it is small. Each component itself is small. It's lambda large. This component is small. So it's supposed to be relevant.
Okay, so we have now a coffee break. Another comment? Or you want to continue directly? Until the schedule says 13:40.
The last down 4 will be
15 minutes.